Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Opening soon, the greatest comedy ever to hit the screen, Superman, the other movie. You'll see fantastic cinematography and dramatic acting.
But when the Big Bang comes and you're all being blown to bits, don't come running to me. No way.
See David Gerald as the brilliant Kryptonian scientist Jell-O. Bijou Trimble and Kirk Allen as foster parents Ma and Pa Kent. Albie Moore as Perry Blight, editor-in-chief of The Daily Comet. David Dubner as cuddly cub reporter Jimmy Nielsen. Trisha Matthews as Lois Lame, ace reporter for The Daily Comet. Sir Daniel Sanchez as the world-famous mad genius Rex Ruther, arch-nemesis of Superman. Melinda McGuire as his beautiful bouncing bosom buddy, Miss Tushmaker. Drex Reed as the evil Kryptonian criminal, General Zit. And starring Mark Radzinski as mild-mannered reporter Clark Kent, who, in reality, is Superman! Yes, you'll go nuts over Superman! You'll laugh till you drop! So hang in there, it's coming soon! Superman! The other movie!
Welcome to another episode of the Projection Booth. I'm Mike White.
And I'm Rob St. Mary.
This week we're looking at the 1981 film Superman, the other movie. This half-hour parody was 3 years in the making by a group of friends from Orange Coast College out in California. The story is a little familiar. Dying planet, baby sent to Earth, which grows up to be a superhero. Yes, we're talking about the story of Moses, or of Superman, which opened in 1978. I guess we should mention here, too, that Superman opened in 1978. Superman 2 opened in June of 1981, meaning that Superman was produced in those intervening years and premiered just a few months before Superman 2. So, Rob, what did you think about Superman?
I thought it was really interesting. I mean, it's kind of a fun little piece, especially when you look at it through the lens of the references to not only Superman, but all the references to culture at the time in the late 70s.
Yeah, definitely. It's a nice little time capsule, I guess. And I actually was very amused by it quite a bit. I mean, there were quite a few jokes where I actually laughed out loud at it.
The thing I like also is you have the planet. Well, you know, it's Krypton in Superman, correct? But in this, it's Krapton.
Right.
So there's all these little kind of small references and parodies and things like that. One of the things that I liked is in the very beginning, I think it's probably even some of the first words that are in the film, is there's this tribunal. And the tribunal is looking at three different people who all have some sort of reference to the film industry. So you can tell that this film was really made by film fans.
The facts I have presented to you are all too real. The criminals you see before you have committed crimes of the most foul and debased nature. General Zit,
who tried to sell the mining rights on Krapton to movie theaters throughout the galaxy. Ulcer, who conspired to water down the soft drinks and sell them at twice the price. And this mindless dolt who calls himself a projectionist, but who consistently refuses to keep the picture in focus.
Members of the council, what is your verdict?
Guilty. Guilty. Guilty? Guilty.
The vote must be unanimous, Jell-O. Join us. I will give you half the popcorn concession. I will throw the sales of Hershey bars in, too. My final offer. Popcorn, Hershey bars, and jujubes!
So, obviously, these are film fans who are a little bit upset at the studio system and movie theaters for not really presenting movies, I guess, in a quality manner.
Apparently, the whole impetus to make this thing was that the studio's kind of beating the "You Will Believe a Man Can Fly" tagline into everybody's heads and promising all this stuff of, hey, you know, this is going to be, you will not, this is crazy. This, you're going to be blown away by these special effects. and then find out that, you know, it's kind of the old wire and green screen kind of stuff that they've been doing all along. And the guys who made this were just like, what the hell? And just kind of, we're not going to ruin the interview segment here, but originally they were going to make kind of a behind the scenes thing of the making of Superb Man, and almost more of like a And God Spoke or This is Spinal Tap kind of a thing, where you kind of go behind the scenes of what's really happening.
Also, it's the little things that are sort of peppered throughout, where there's little tiny jokes. I mean, obviously, there's big, broad sort of Borscht Belt-esque sort of.
Right. There's a pie fight in this film.
Yeah.
Nothing's all about that.
Yeah. Three Stooges, vaudeville, Borscht Belt kind of corny jokes kind of thing. But then there's like little things, like in one of the opening scenes, several of the characters who are on the planet on Krapton, they all have these outfits, you know, these futuristic outfits, and it's like each one features a logo from the major TV networks in right. some way. So, I mean, it has sort of this, like we talked about before with Frankenhooker, that to me it has like a Cracked magazine aesthetic. I don't think it raises to the level of Mad magazine. It's not sharp enough, or even National Lampoon, but it definitely has sort of this lowbrow sort of parody, which was well known in, and I would say both the magazines, but definitely more in Cracked magazine.
Right. Well, I think the thing that really comes through, and when I was watching this, what I really was enjoying is that you can tell it was made by folks that were having a good time, you know, and it feels like this is something that was a passion project for folks. And probably, I mean, it took 3 years to make this thing. So probably after a little while, it was like, really, again, we're still working on this thing. But, you know, it was something that folks felt necessary to do, you know, to go out and shoot this thing on weekends and evenings and that kind of stuff. And just that's the passion that they had for this really kind of comes through on screen for me.
And when we talk about some of the casting, there's a couple of people who are well-known. One that's obviously a well-known voice, and another, I would say, who's doing a parody of his own shtick from a show that was probably 10 years before this. So you have Gary Owens, who's a well-known radio announcer, well-known voiceover guy.
You would always see him on Laugh-In doing his thing.
That's it. And then you have Alvy Moore, which, if I say Alvy Moore, to most people, they don't know who he is. But if I say Mr. Kimball from Green Acres, the sort of scatterbrained county agent, then they go, ah, okay. And he plays the editor of the newspaper where Kent goes to get a job, obviously filling in the whole Superman mythology. And he basically is doing a riff of Mr. Kimball, just this fumbling, sweet-natured but sort of absent-minded guy. And I thought it was really nice to see him, because outside of Green Acres, I can't really say that I know anything else that he was in.
Hello, Lois. What are those rewrites? All of a sudden, where's my coffee?
I don't care if it's mountain grown. Hello? No, I don't want to stop the presses for a story about a boring dog. Oh, you just saw a flying saucer. I suppose Nicky will have me believe a man can fly.
So you want to be a reporter, huh, Kent?
Yes, sir, Mr. Black.
Well, I'll tell you, Kent. Pump's a great paper.
Well, maybe it's not a great paper, but it's certainly a lot better than some of those grocery store tabloids you find around. Well, maybe it's not a lot better either, but it has the best classified ad in the city.
The other thing I thought was interesting, too, and this is kind of a fun little riff that seems to me like someone went and saw Flash Gordon, because Flash mm-hmm. Gordon obviously came out in 80, I believe, 79 or 80, is that instead of it being Lex Luthor, it's a guy by the name of Rex Ruther, which, you know, if you live in Detroit, Walter Ruther is a – I don't know. Maybe they were trying to make a comment on unions, but was the head of the UAW for a long time. But he plays this, like, Ming the Merciless kind of thing, where he's got this, like, Chinese Fu Manchu, and he's got a bald head and speaks in this sort of ridiculous sort of, Fu Manchu Chinese accent and all this, and a bald cap. And that was kind of funny to me because, I mean, already we know – Lex Luthor is bald, you know, right. Either be in the film or be in the comic books. But to go, okay, we're going to sort of like mix mythologies here, because it was like two big sort of like sci-fi geek films that came out. You had, well, there was a couple actually in the late 70s, if you want to include Star Wars, but you have Superman, and then you also have this riff to Flash Gordon. The guy who plays Superb Man, what's sort of your take on him?
I thought he did a pretty good job. Mark Grudzinski, I think his name is. And yeah, I thought he did a good job. I mean, he looks, there's no kind of real transition between his Clark Kent and Superman other than the glasses thing. You know, he pretty much is the same character either way. I like that he's kind of geeky and, yeah, I thought he did a fairly good job. The guy who I really liked was the guy who played General Zit in this film, but the General Zod character.
Yeah, the guy who played that did a really nice job. The guy who played Superman, I thought, as the first time I watched it, you know, given sort of the haircut and his demeanor, he sort of seemed like a less neurotic Albert Brooks to me.
Yeah, I can see that. And then the what's her name? It's Tessmacher in the film. Is it Tushmaker? In this one. Oh my God, so annoying. I mean, they must have really hated Miss Tessmacher.
But Ray.
But I was glad that they kind of, you know, they were very consistent in their tone across everything. And it's funny just like how much stuff they shot and never used. I mean, even if you watch the preview, there's like, you know, the preview's what, a minute and a half or something, and there are so many shots that are in the preview that aren't in the final film.
Yeah, you can definitely say that when you have these sort of labor of love projects, that sometimes the trailer will look a little different than the final product. You know, you'll have different people in it, you'll have different shots, maybe an alternate take or something like that. I know that's definitely the case with some smaller films, especially features, where people make trailers to try and get the money to actually make the film. So they just shoot some of their best scenes and kind of slap it all together to get people to, you know, write them checks. So I definitely know that's the case with something like the South Park guys when they did Cannibal the Musical. If you watch the trailer I think is the fundraising trailer for that thing. And some of the people look a little different and stuff like that, as opposed to just taking lifts out of the actual film.
Right, and that was another one where I think it took years for them to film that thing.
That's what's great about this kind of stuff. I mean, you have with this film really sort of the roots of a lot of that, you know, fan fiction or fan films that now are sort of just the basis for like a lot of the geeky stuff on YouTube. Like everyone's doing like, you know, versions of Lord of the Rings or something, or, you know, Star Wars tributes in some way, you know. So it's doing all, I remember, what was it, back in the mid 80s, there were these guys who spent a couple of years doing like a shot for shot remake with an old video camera of the first Indiana Jones film in their backyard or something. I think things like this movie is sort of where that all begins.
Yeah, totally. All right, so we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to play an interview with Superman's director and producer.
All right, I'm here with Bill Byforce and Mr. Chris to tell you a little bit about Outside the Cinema.
All right, Reverend Scott, take us to church.
What can we expect to find from a typical show?
2 hours of just random blabber.
Is there anyone's coattails you rode in on to popularity?
I'm the guy that f***ing burns the coattails and then pisses on them.
You review all these exploitation, horror, comedy, cult, and often all-around terrible movies. You must have a strong driving force that keeps you going.
Ego.
I don't know if I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while.
Really?
I have been saying that for a while. Also, I'm high on smack.
Well, it's definitely working for you guys. People are coming out in droves to support you on iTunes.
We just the other day got a one-star review on iTunes.
Well, that is one star too many. Let me tell you, the worst f***ing piece of shit I've ever heard.
This has been great, guys.
Thanks, Scott. That was good. Oh, he's got you crying over there.
I'm good for the rest of the year.
Nice.
That was too much.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
T tell me the very beginnings of the project. I want to know how this thing came about. I mean, this is an origin story film as it is. So tell me the origins of the origins. Tell me the origins of Superb Man.
All of us were in the film department at Orange Coast College in Costa Mesa. And we had all been doing our own, you know, separate projects. And we would all get together in Vern's garage that he had converted into sort of a studio. And we would get together and we would show films. I mean, this was, you know, back in the days when we didn't have computers and we didn't have TVs. We didn't even have VHS, for heaven's sakes. We actually would get a projector and find films, most of them that we either did ourselves or actually ones seriously that we found. And we would throw them up in the projector and we would play them. And we had done that for a while. And then one day or one night, I swear, there came a point where we all looked at each other and we said, we should make a movie. We should make another movie. Why are we sitting here watching films and not making another movie? And that's how I remember it.
Yeah, that's basically how it started. And then John Ginn, who wrote the film, he went off and he had this basic idea of about a making, well, first of all, he was really obsessed with the absurdity of how much trouble and time and money it took to make the Superman movie. Because, you know, they kept talking, you'll believe a man could fly and so on and so forth. So he put together this idea of this character called Dinklus, which is, of course, Salkin backwards.
That's humor.
Comedy. And I'm laughing all the way to the bank. So he wrote that and we started shooting it.
Well, it was going to be like Hardware Wars. It wasn't going to be a film. It was going to be a film about a film. It was going to be the making of Superman. It wasn't going to be Superman.
And all the problems they had doing it.
You played Dinklus.
I played Dinklus.
Yes, you did.
Typecasting. From there, it just kind of started growing out of control because what would happen would be, well, we needed to show them actually shooting the film. So we had to come up with a couple of scenes where they were shooting the film and things were going wrong.
And actually, a lot of those scenes that were originally part of the behind-the-scenes making of are in the film, and they're up towards the front of the film, like the ones in the Kraptonian Council and, you know, all the stuff on Krapton because it was the coolest stuff. Because it was coming out kind of cool, or we thought it was coming out kind of cool, we said, hey, why are we wasting our time making a film about the film? Let's just make the dang film.
And then also about this time, we were spending a lot of time going to sci-fi conventions, and I was meeting all kinds of childhood heroes in the film business.
Yeah, I have to interject. The early 80s, late 70s in Los Angeles was a time when there were a lot of really, really cool science fiction conventions and really cool people and a close-knit community. And we just sort of got into it.
Yeah.
And one thing led to another. And Vern can sell refrigerators to Eskimos, which is what he did.
So what I would do is I would just walk up to these people and, you know, say, hey, we're making this film. We think you'd be great in this part. Would you be interested in doing it? 9 times out of 10, they said yes.
That's how we got Kirk Allen. That's how we got Bicho. Mm-hmm. That's how we got Alvy. We got David Gerald.
David Gerald.
They were just all people who were going to the conventions that we were meeting at the convention.
Oh, and also Gary Owens from Laugh-In.
Dave, had you directed stuff before this?
I'd only done my own films. We all did everything on this film. When we got to the end and we decided that it would look funny if we just had one big title that said we all did everything on this film with our names after it, we decided to divvy up the loot.
Yeah, he's being modest, though. The truth is he really was the spearheading, making sure it stayed on track.
Well, yeah, but there are scenes that you directed, and there are, especially the ones I was in, and there are scenes that other people directed, and then I was producing sometimes, and you were producing sometimes, because it's just that much work. Or at least in the old days, it was that much work.
At one point, we stopped production when we realized how out of control it was getting, and we sat down and we rewrote it.
Yeah. We should have a finished script before we go any further.
Yeah. We rewrote it, and I started doing storyboards. Now, I'm not much of a sketch artist. Dave, on the other hand, he's a professional artist.
So I jumped in and did some of the storyboards, too. But we both did some of the storyboards. We both found the locations. Vern would get us the location. That's the thing. You know, Vern was fearless. I think he's still fearless, but he was really fearless back in those days.
And now he's just hairless.
Now he's just hairless, yes. And he would walk up to anyone and ask for anything, and he'd usually get it. You know, we got some great locations. We got some great, like, pie goop, and we got, you know, when we shot the pie fight, he ended up getting us... 50 extras or more?
At least twice. One of the three times we were shooting on Super Bowl Sunday, and we didn't know it. And so we had all of our crew.
We're not sports fans.
No. So we had all of our equipment, all of our crew, and it was a lot of gear to put together out at Golden West College campus. And we're like, okay, there's no one here.
Yeah, where is everybody, Vern? So, it was like, Vern, where is everybody? Where are your extras, Vern? And this is before cell phones. If you look in the pie fight also, there's a blue van there. That doesn't belong to any of us. Vern actually went to a Ford dealership and said, can we borrow that van? And they went, okay.
It was the same principle as trying to get professional actors in the film. I had nothing to lose by asking. So we used Huntington Center Mall, which at the time was a big shopping center in Huntington Beach. It's now called Belaterra. I got a bank in Westminster, which was...
We were in the bank after hours, too.
Yeah.
With only one guy, I think we could have overpowered it.
Bank president, yeah.
Yes.
But it was really cool about it is it was... And what would you call it? Tudor?
Yeah,
style?
It was... Yeah.
The Tudor style, the interior, fireplaces. It's just awesome.
Really sad is that scene got cut out, or one of those scenes got cut out, yeah.
And then I was able to get a GTE, which was at that time German.
Oh, that's right. You got the phone booth. You didn't get the phone booth once. You got it twice.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a blue one and a red one.
Right.
I can't remember which one's where, but one of them is at the shopping center, and the other one is the one that's at Abco. Yeah.
Yeah.
The exterior of the Daily Planet.
Yeah.
Daily Comet.
Daily Comet.
Yeah.
You guys mentioned a few times some of the cut scenes on the making of documentary. What were some of the things that we're not seeing?
Fortress of Solitude.
We cut them out because at the time we wanted to have a one reel film. And there was a length that you had to be under in order to be one reel of film. And that was, I think, the main reason we cut them out.
Yeah.
The other reason was, I think we were actually, some of them I don't miss.
Yeah.
But some of them I do miss.
Yeah.
Clark Kent going through the Fortress of Isolation.
Oh, that's right. See, you remember these things.
Yeah, I don't know why. We had Rex Reuther and... Miss Tushmaker doing another dialogue scene in their dining room, which was really cool. It was a great location.
Beautiful. And the truth is, you know, in retrospect, when I look at it, you know, I think it could easily lose about 5 to 10 minutes and be a tighter, faster film.
In those days, things didn't happen as fast.
No, that's true.
I think we've changed in the last 30 years. Unfortunately, Vern still has all of...
I have all
in boxes.
Box, yes.
That he's carried around with him for 30 years, but we still have them. We've got a reel that has those scenes on it, and
in fact, it's called "Scenes You Never Saw."
Yeah, it's called "Scenes You Never Saw," and it's probably 200 feet. I'm guessing maybe 6 minutes.
Yeah.
Our problem now is that technology doesn't exist anymore. With that 16 millimeter, all that equipment that you could run 16 millimeter film on. And look at it and watch it in sync, literally does not exist.
The audio is on what's called mag film, and the film is a separate piece, and it's all tape splices, which would have to have all dried up and have come apart, which would have to be re-spliced.
Well, if we had a chem table, we could probably run it, because the chem table's pretty gentle on that stuff. But Cal State Long Beach, who, you know, I still work for Cal State Long Beach. I could easily get access to any equipment there. But the problem is the equipment doesn't exist.
We had tons of money. I'm sure there are places where you could, you know, do it. I mean, for example, when we did the, we transferred the one word print we had, or answer print we had of the film, and we took it up to Photocam, and they transferred and they did a color correction. Unfortunately, their color correction job was not to our satisfaction. I don't know if it's because of lack of time or what.
We didn't know what we were doing. I wouldn't blame them.
Yeah.
We had never transferred a film before, and part of the cost of transferring it was actually having a timing session with a real timing guy, which was really cool. But I think what we didn't realize was that as he was timing new scenes, I don't think he was watching his dials or something, because scenes that we had gone past and we had said, that's okay, when we later got them, we went, how come they're purple now?
Yeah. So I had to, when I brought the film into Final Cut, I had to do what I could to correct as much of the color as I could. What we'd love to do is, we had the time and the money, is to take the original. See, that was the other problem. We had to do a print rather than the original, because the original is set up in what's called an A-B roll fashion because of the way we did the special effects. And also, this film was, because we were poor and we didn't have the money to buy negative to shoot on, we shot on what's called reverse film, which is essentially, it's like having slide film. It's a positive.
Yeah, things have changed so much since then. Reversal film is actually the same film that they used to use to shoot news footage, because it could be processed really, really quick, and it was cheap, and you could have it on the news that night.
Very high contrast, too.
And negative, we just couldn't afford negative back in those
days. The point is again, to get a good transfer of what we have, they would have to go through and, again, fix all the splices, because, again, those are glue splices. Those would all have to be re-glued. It'd be an enormous amount of money, and right now it's just not in pocketbook.
Going back to when you guys decided, you know, hey, let's go ahead and do this, and you said that you had been watching a lot of films, was there one particular film that kind of inspired you? Were you watching something really awful, and you just said, God, we could do a lot better than this?
Well, I hesitate to say this, but I know that we at that time Hardware Wars had come out, and we watched it, and it was playing everywhere, and we had seen it like, you know,
hundreds of times,
because they were showing it everywhere. They were showing it at all these conventions that we were going to.
Yeah.
And I got it. We're going to get in trouble. But we saw Hardware Wars, and I would say that was the one that we said, and we could do better than that.
Yeah. I mean, theirs was, what, maybe 5 minutes long? We did 30 minutes.
I don't even think it was five minutes long.
But, and not to knock them, really, because, you know, they did what they did, and it worked. I mean, it was funny. You know, it's still out there in circulation today.
Oh, you can buy a DVD of it.
Yeah.
I'm very curious, when you guys mentioned on the doc, too, about the film being on television, how did you manage to wangle that?
Yeah, it's the same thing as all the other things I did. I simply called up, and I started calling distributors, and I started calling TV stations, and I say, hey, we've got this project, and I finally got somebody who was interested. It was, at that time, that was when cable and the pay-per-view was just starting to hit the market on television, and there was a company called On TV, and they were interested, so I took the film up, I screened it for them, and they said, sure, cool. And we got paid for it, and it ran...
Well, we actually did it twice. It ran twice.
I mean, it was actually in, you know, TV Guide and listed, Superman and the other. In fact, there was a nice little color picture and some copy on it.
What was really strange was years later, and I mean years later, because this was in the 90s, I went to a toy convention. It didn't have anything to do with science fiction at all. And I'm walking around, and I'm looking at stuff, and a guy is sort of looking at me, you know, kind of funny. And he walks over to me and says, are you Jiminy Olsen? I went, oh, man. And that was like 15 or more years later. I couldn't believe it. And he said that he had seen it on. I'm surprised that there are a lot of people who saw it on TV.
I'm still amazed that after 30 years, there's interest in this film. It's just a student film.
And you know what's really funny is people who see our movie, they see our movie, and then if they go watch, and they may not get it, but then if they then watch either of the Superman films, they start laughing because they remember the jokes in our film.
That's an interesting point there, because when we were making Superman, we were between Superman 1 and Superman 2. We were guessing.
Totally guessing.
What Superman 2 was going to be about. We were right on the money.
Yeah, you would think that we had seen the movie, but actually, no. We made our film in between.
We had no script. We were totally guessing.
Yeah, how long did it take you guys to make the film?
Remember, we were all film majors at Orange Coast College.
Well, let's give you the answer. 2 years.
No, it was longer than that, I think, because we started, I think, in We probably started thinking about it in 76. I think we started thinking about Dinklus in 76.
Yeah, you're right.
And because we were already at Cal State Long Beach by 77 and 78. So yeah. I would say that we were at Orange Coast. We were all film majors at Orange Coast.
That's how we met.
And we started shooting the Dinklus stuff. At Orange Coast.
Yes.
We wore out our welcome, basically. They got really tired of us, and they said, no, we're not going to let you use the equipment anymore. Go away. And at that point, we really thought it was over.
Yeah.
I was a student at Cal State. Then I was a student at Cal State Long Beach, and I was in the industrial design program, still am. And
now he's a teacher, a professor.
Professor, yes. We had a connection to the film department because our industrial design program there had actually worked with the film program, had made movies. And then also all of the guys who made the first Star Wars film, including Joe Johnston and Charlie Bailey and Lauren Peterson and Steve Golley and John Dykstra, were all alumni. They were all from the industrial design program at Cal State Long Beach. So we had sort of a film connection. So what I did, I just went over and started asking around at the film department, and I ran into Steve Hubbard, and he was interested. Then we brought all of our stuff up one day, and we showed it to Steve, and we said, look, this is what we've got. This is what we're doing. We'd really like to finish this. You want to give us a chance? And much to our surprise, he said yes, which I'm still shocked at. And actually, Steve still works there.
Yeah, in the film department.
And in fact, I just saw him the other day. He gave us the equipment, and he would let us use it when the film students weren't using it. So we shot like on over vacation, and we shot over the summertime, and that's when we made the film.
And we'd almost work in 24-hour shifts sleeping there. There'd be three of us editing at any one time. There'd be Dave, Drex, and myself.
And on an old Moviola, so whoever's listening to this, Google Moviola. It's a really horrendous-looking torture device that you run film through.
Yeah, but at one point, they did give us the flatbed editor. So we had.
Yeah, but you guys spent a lot of time on the Moviola, and I'll never forget, you had to sync up the stuff that we shot at Orange Coast College because we had a crappy camera.
Yeah.
And you had to sync it up by cutting out frames. And God, that took forever.
Yeah.
Was there a lot of overdubbing that you guys had to do? Because there's only like one or two scenes where I can really hear overdubs.
Actually, I don't think there are any overdubs in it.
Just bad sound.
It's just bad sound.
There's the part where up in the sky, just you and I, that at the end.
Oh, at the end. Okay.
Yeah, that's an overdub. But in terms of actually actors watching his performance and trying to sync to it, no, we didn't do that.
We actually tried to do the overdubs. We really did. We brought Alvy in to overdub his scene because actually his scene was one of the first scenes that we shot. And consequently, it was with the Orange Coast equipment and it was out of sync. And so it was undercranked. So it actually moves a little too fast. You can probably notice that when you watch the movie. And so we wanted to overdub his, but he just couldn't do it. It just didn't sound right. It didn't feel right when he did it.
And because it was too fast, and he was doing it in normal speed.
So we just left it.
And there's another example of getting a great location. That was a real newsroom. That was the Orange County Register newspaper's real operational newsroom, which we shot in the middle of the night.
In the middle of the night, yeah.
Vern, I want to know, what was the thing that you tried to do in this film that you weren't able to? Because it sounds like you did a whole heck of a lot and were able to talk a lot of folks into giving you and allowing you to do a whole lot of things.
We actually had operational R2-D2 and C-3PO at the Pie Fight. And we shot a scene where C-3PO gets a big old pie in the face.
Yeah.
And
R2-D2 gets R2-D2 a pie in the face.
And we had it, and we wrote Lucasfilms and asked for permission to use it. We're talking about what? Maybe it.
Isn't that in blooper reel? I think it's in the blooper reel.
Maybe.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't hear this.
You didn't hear that. Don't tell George that we put it in the blooper
reel. Just put a little boop. And that's the only thing that didn't make it into the film that I would have liked to have seen in there.
Yeah, it was fun. We actually wrote an epilogue. It tied the Otis character, who really just walks through the film. It gave him a reason for being in the film. And actually, when we fade out to black at the end, you come up with this epilogue. And the Otis character comes into a darkened room. And he's carrying something, and he hands it to a mysterious figure. And the mysterious figure opens the box, and he pulls out what looks like a miniature planet of Krapton, only it's glowing green. And he holds it up to his face, and it turns out to be Mike Jitlove, the Wizard of Speed and Time.
Right.
And he says, with this crap tonight, I will rule, you know, destroy
Superman
and rule the world. And then we were going to go.
He flies off and he crashes into a billboard.
So we tried to work that out with Mike Jitlove. And mind you, Mike Jitlove and I and us, we're still good friends, but Mike just didn't want to do it. But that would have been great. That would have been a great ending.
Yeah, in fact, we met Mike early on when he was getting recognition for his films at the conventions, and that's how we got to know each other. In fact, he and I spent a good deal of time together on the East Coast at the Worldcon. Was it 82?
He was really big at the conventions back then when we were making our film.
So it sounds like Uncle George wasn't your friend on this one. How about DC? Did they ever have any problems with this?
No, we've never had any hassle with it. The fact of the matter, it's a parody. We've changed things sufficiently enough that it's covered by fair use. So, there hasn't been a headache so far. In fact, the irony is they've actually stolen from us. Maybe that's a little harsh word, but let's put it this way. There is now a Superman comic book.
Oh, there was.
And, we came up with the name Superman first.
Yeah, our lawyers will talk to their lawyers anytime.
I have to ask, when will folks be able to order this?
I'm looking at Vern.
Okay, here's where we stand. We've got it basically done. There are some little technical glitches that we're trying to work out. In fact, we're going to hopefully work on some of that after we hang up here with you. It's conceivable by the summer, but then we've said that for 4 years or 5 years.
You've said it for 4 years or 5 years.
It's kind of like when we used to have a banner. After we made Superman, we made another banner called, it was what, 1980 what? Something
we, it was the year, 1981, the year we make movies.
And we kept changing that banner. It hung up on the wall. And every year for almost 10 years, that banner changed.
We would change the numbers on it.
Yeah. At one point, he stopped reprinting the banner, and he just printed out new numbers and replaced them.
Yeah, we stuck the new numbers up. That was funny.
But seriously speaking, I would like to have it out this summer. Once we have the pressings done, I will tell you, and if you want to tell the world, we'd love to have you do that.
One of the things that I think we're a little jealous of, if I can, complain for just a moment.
And he can.
Is that people don't appreciate how frickin' hard it was to make a movie back then. It was really hard. And we would make, we would shoot the film. We would send it to the lab. We'd have to wait for it to be processed. And, usually you get dailies. But we couldn't afford dailies, so we had weeklies or monthlies.
Yeah.
So we wouldn't know if what we shot was any good until we got it back a week or several weeks later.
And many cases, on several occasions, we got stuff back that wasn't good because of technical issues.
You just don't have those problems anymore. That plus, just the fact of having to cut the film, physically cut the film. Now we both use Final Cut Pro. Wow, what a difference.
And here's the other thing is, if you think it was hard to make the movie, it was even harder to get distribution, to get, what you've made to an audience. Now, with the advent of the internet and YouTube and things like it, people can reach not just a few hundred, they can, in some cases, reach millions. I mean, you think of Freddie Wong.
Yeah.
Now, there's a guy that's getting, 6 to 7 million views on his videos.
But I think the one thing that we did right, and the advice that I would give to any aspiring filmmakers, is to just have absolute total courage. I tell my students today the same thing. They don't understand how powerful the student card is, and I tell them to play the student card.
Oh, yeah.
If you're a student and you walk up to anyone, it could be the biggest person, in the world, the most famous person in the world, and you say, I'm just a dumb student. Will you help me out? It's amazing what you can get.
Yeah, you can go, hi there, Mr. Lucas. I'm a student filmmaker. Can you help me? Can I use your R2-D2 in my production?
And that's what we did. And, it still works. It still works.
It does. Even at my age, I'm still playing that card because, if I'm out there shooting something.
Kind of old for a student, aren't you?
I believe in continuing education.
Oh, okay.
But the point is if you're out there shooting and you don't have permits, you just do the old, oh, gee, I didn't know you have to have permits, huh? I'm just a student filmmaker. I
at the Elder University.
It's 30 years later after you guys, embarked on this and got this all done and everything. it sounds like you guys are still hanging out, still having a good time. Do you still talk to some of the other folks that were involved with the project?
We see all these people all the time. Like I said, I actually saw Steve Hubbard Wednesday.
And about the only person we've lost contact with, really, is Mark Brzezinski, who played Superman. He's kind of dropped off the face of the earth, though I believe somebody else said
recently somebody said that they'd seen him and talked to him.
But like Drex, who did the special effects.
We just saw him a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. And then Dan Sanchez, who played
Rex Ruther.
He and I share a house together.
And we see John all the time.
John Ginn. In fact, I was just up in Oregon last week, and it's kind of an irony because he was just down here last month, and I didn't get to see him. I was just up there last week, and we couldn't meet. And he's supposed to be down here again sometime next month. So and I'm sure we'll see him then.
And we're both Facebooked to Bijo. So, yeah, we see a lot of these folks still.
Did you guys ever make anything else other than Superman together?
I went on to do a video or documentary video for an aerospace company for a number of years. And now I do documentary video of the things that happen in my program up at Cal State Long Beach. Other than that, no, not much of anything.
Yeah, and not until recently I haven't made anything. I do video production for one of my clients, an automotive aftermarket company, and I shoot a lot of automotive events and that sort of thing. But then back in August, just for the fun of it, I started fooling around with a character on here in front of the camera, and I came up with a character called UFO Bob. And then Dave and I, on the spur of the moment with a no script, just like in the old days when we were kids, we ran out into a field and started shooting stuff, and it's on YouTube now.
That's actually, when you've made enough movies and watched enough movies, you sort of get the rhythm programmed into your brain. And really, that's the same way that like Buster Keaton and some of the old guys used to do it. They would just get a camera and they'd go do it. And that is just an amazing, fun experience, just to go out with a camera and just make it up as you go. And
you take advantage of whatever situations, events, props.
Yeah, whatever's
locations.
There, whatever you come across, it's a blast. And now with, you know, the cheap little video cameras, you're not losing anything. You're not wagering anything.
I mean, when we were shooting Superman, we would literally be counting how many feet we had left on reel and trying to shoot right up to the last foot of film, because it was so expensive to buy and so expensive to process.
I don't know who it is, but some famous filmmaker was saying recently, or he has said quite often, hey, you want to become a filmmaker? Go out and make movies. It's that simple.
Welcome back to the Projection Booth. I hope to talk to Dave and Vern again one of these days about another movie project they were involved with, Salvation for the Planet of the Apes. This was kind of a proposed next chapter to the Apes series, which blurred the line between what we'd consider a fan film, quote-unquote, and something officially sanctioned and produced by a major studio. Fan films weren't something that started in the 1970s, but they certainly kind of had some legs back then. I'm thinking of films like Superman, of course, and then Closet Cases of the Nerd Kind, Hardware Wars, those kind of things. Rob, what are some of your favorite fan films?
Well, I remember the one that I thought was really funny and inventive, and it used to come on the DVD editions of Night of the Living Dead, was Night of the Living Bread. I thought that was kind of funny.
Oh, nice. Closet Cases and Hardware Wars, they used to show those things all the time on cable. They were kind of like little fillers on HBO, like I think it was HBO. You know, if a movie ran short or something, they would kind of throw those on. So you never knew when they were going to show up, but it was always great to see them. And then years later, I remember renting the VHS where those two were on there, and then another film which I actually found funnier than either one of those two was Porklips Now, which was kind of a parody of Apocalypse Now. I still quote them all these years later. I mean, there are lines that I'm always doing from Closet Cases. This means something. It kind of became part of, you know, my movie vernacular almost.
Yeah, and I think that a good parody, I think it usually works on two levels. One is that it obviously is a tribute to the original piece, but it also shows that you have enough love or feel that people have enough knowledge about the background on these films or they've seen these movies, that you can have a few jokes. You can kind of, you know, take a few hits at the pinata that is this thing and, you know, maybe knock a few pieces of candy out. And that's what I think really works well with these fan films, is when someone can kind of rise to that kind of level.
Right. Yeah, there's this whole thing in Pork Lips now where you see a silhouette of the director, a very thinly veiled Francis Ford Coppola, who is showing multiple endings for the film as it goes through. You know, no, we shot this one. You know, I wanted to take a look at this. And oh, it is so good. I love that so much. And there's a great book. Read this one. Oh, gosh, it was probably about 2 years now. It's called Homemade Hollywood: Fans Behind the Camera by Clive Young. And it really dives deep into a lot of these films. He actually went and talked to the guys who made the Raiders film that you had talked about earlier, the shot-for-shot remake, where, you know, again, we're talking about how long some of these projects make. You can actually see the kids getting older as the film is going on because it took so long for them to do. Clive Young, he really dives deep into this. I mean, he goes all the way back into like the 1930s and these kind of, there were some 1930s and 40s, I think it is, when some of the really older stuff. But I'd have to say that for me, I mean, maybe just because of when I was born and everything, it felt like the 1970s were kind of where this stuff took off. I think it was because, you know, film had become cheap enough and, you know, the consumer level cameras were good enough. And then when you get into the early 80s, that's when you've got people with camcorders and doing these, you know, VHS tributes. And for me, it's just, you know, it kind of really went from there. And now it's like kind of a mix of people remixing things where you take pre-existing stuff and make that your own. I mean, fan editors or people doing mashups, those kind of things. And then folks who are actually out shooting stuff. I mean, again, we're kind of in this golden era of consumer level video equipment being affordable and easy enough to use. And then with YouTube, you've got a distribution channel, and it's just, you know, kind of crazy how this fan phenomenon has carried along with us throughout the years and has morphed and changed and done so many different things.
Well, that's the thing, as you said before, when you had things like Hardware Wars and things like that, I mean, it was sort of catch as catch can, maybe on cable as a filler, or maybe it came out on VHS and you were able to get it at a certain video store or something like that. Now the distribution channels are wide open. So, and the means of production, as you were saying, are so cheap. And I think really going back to what you were saying, this sort of like lifting in the 70s, I think maybe one thing that was sort of behind it may have been the fact that you had sound Super 8 film. That right. That was cheap enough. I mean, you didn't have video yet, but you had a method of shooting sync sound pieces that wasn't 16 millimeter with dual system, or even to go to what John Waters was doing with sort of like news cameras, you know, where you had Magstripe or something like that on the side of the 16. So you had the means of production that were coming down far enough, and it really opened up the door. And that's the thing that I joke about, even as far back as the late 90s, when I had made my vampire film. I mean, we still made that on 16 because that was still considered a legitimate format because digital video had not come in yet. And I talked to other filmmakers here in the Detroit area, and there are plenty of them, and a lot of them are my friends. And I say, you know, you guys are so lucky now. You can basically do whatever because the means are so cheap for you to actually get something together and actually get people to see it. It doesn't matter. I mean, you probably won't make any money on it. I mean, I didn't make any money on my vampire movie. But the thing is that you can just go out and just crank out stuff and experiment and learn and do all that stuff. And that's a great way to go. And, you know, the one thing with these fan films is that they don't all have to be parodies. They don't all have to be comedies. You can have something like Zachary Oberzan, who did Flooding with Love for the Kid, which is a faithful adaptation of David Morrell's First Blood, which is the book that First Blood, the Stallone film, and then obviously the Rambo character is based on. We're going to be talking about that probably about a month from now on our, as I now call it, the mega epic episode of First Blood. But you have something that's really about a guy with Flooding with Love for the Kid, where he's got a studio apartment in New York. It's 200 and something odd square feet, and he does everything. He shot it, he edited, he's every single character in the film, and basically just used whatever he had in the apartment and comes out with a film that is very moving. The performances are incredible. After a while, you don't even really even notice that he's shooting this in his apartment because you can get into that universe. And I think that's what all of these do. I think good films, it doesn't matter if you're making them on less than $100, like Flooding with Love for the Kid, or you're making them on, you know, thousands of dollars or even more, and even major Hollywood films, is that it has the possibility to take you somewhere and take you out of your head and really get you to interact with these characters and really care about them. And that's become sort of the transformative power of the art form, at least in my opinion.
Continuing on that, yeah, $100 thing. I mean, YouTube, you're not going to make money off of YouTube. And, you know, obviously, I don't think that Ernie Ford Fasilius was making, you know, money hand over fist when it came to Hardware Wars and Apocalypse Now. But he was very fortunate to have those things out on video. Obviously, people aren't going to start making fan films with hundreds of millions of dollars in mind as far as profit. So it's very smart that you can make these movies for cheap and be able to distribute them for nothing and get paid nothing, basically, you know, as opposed to, you know, coming out and saying like, oh yeah, I'm going to make all this money off of this fan film, which a lot of it is, you know, really kind of skirting this gray area of intellectual property. I mean, at least with Superbman, you fall in Hardware Wars and those kind of things, you fall under the whole parody thing. So you don't have to worry about like the legalities of it. But there are other people that are, you know, kind of doing like fan fiction kind of stuff where you're taking someone else's characters or property and kind of doing your own spin on it. It's not a parody. It is, you know, something where you're taking this stuff. I mean, like Flooding with Love, you're literally taking the original book and doing your own version of it. I mean, before there was the Hunger Games movie, there were kids out there doing their own adaptations. They would do either trailer form of this is what we think the movie should look like or what our interpretation of the book into a film would be, or they were doing scenes. I mean, there's that whole Star Wars remix where people do individual scenes of the film and then they were all kind of edited together into one, you know, full form piece. And some of those scenes are parody, but most of them are very faithful adaptations of here's what happened in the movie and here we go. But that's, you know, movie to movie, as opposed to Hunger Games, which was book to fan film kind of thing. So there's all these different varieties of tribute, basically, either to a film or to a book. But the thing that I appreciate about all of them is just this kind of central love that people have for the material.
And I think that's obviously where it comes from. And I think that could be part of the reason also why when people do these, most of the time the filmmakers who did the original usually are approving. They think it's fun, you know, and they're very supportive of it because it really does two things. It's one, it's obviously somebody cares about what you've done so much that they're willing to spend their own time and money to do something that really has no commercial value whatsoever. And then number two, it's just sort of their way of giving a little tip of the hat to you in your own thing. So you could see it as it also helps to prop up the ego of some of the folks in Hollywood. So I'm sure Mr. Lucas needs that because he seems to be a guy who lacks an ego.
Yeah, George Lucas has done a lot of really horrible things, but being approving of the fan films is one of the things that I think he has done right. All the way from Hardware Wars up until today, just it is a gold mine of fan films. And again, talking about no budget, that kind of stuff, I mean, some of the fan films were good enough where they were almost used as like reels and got people real jobs off of them. I'm thinking of like Kevin Rubio, the film Troops, you know, where it was a parody of Cops and of Star Wars, where it was seeing the stormtroopers who were looking for the droids on Tatooine. And it was just amazing special effects. I mean, it was made right at that time when digital effects were starting to become something that people could do on their own and on PCs versus, you know, what a studio can do. And it is just, it's funny, it looks beautiful, and it is spot on with its tone. I mean, seeing Aunt Beru and Uncle Owen fighting like these two rednecks that you would see on Cops is just hilarious. Seeing that whole, like, you know, what if those were the droids we were looking for?
But that's the thing I think's great, is that even if you do a serious film, as you were saying, with something like fan fiction, where there's a lot of scripts or various things that you can find fan fiction sites pretty much for any major property that has a following, is that I think also it's a way for people to interact with something they really care about. And it's their way of saying, I really like this show or I really like this film, but maybe I didn't like the turn that the creators or whoever was writing it or putting it together at the time took with it. So it's my place as a fan who enjoys this stuff to go, you know what, I think it might be a little better is maybe if the characters went this way or something like this happened, or say you've got like a big series or something and the series ends, you can go, I wonder what happened next. It's sort of a way for people who are really into something to sort of open it up and push it a little further with their own creativity and imagination. And I think that's what's really great about something like Superbman.
All right, so we're going to take a break and play a preview from next week's show.
Denise, this is Howard Kazak.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
Hello. Denise just did something you'll never do. She wrote a number one hit.
I mean, what if I can't think up another one like that?
Keep your eyes and ears open. Everyone is in pain. Denise, we need B-sides.
Well, you know, I just want to write for girls, you know, like myself.
All her life, she wrote songs for other people to sing.
This is only until I can record my own stuff.
You're either a singer or a songwriter. Which is it?
I'm both.
Until she listened to her heart.
Would you consider writing a song with me? I think we'd make a good team. You haven't written a single song since you got caught up with this guy. He's costing me money.
And found her own voice.
I'm a singer, and I'm going to record my own stuff.
Since I lost the power to pretend that there could ever be a happy ending.
Stop!
I think we should try to make it big.
If you could just pick yourself up, you'll realize that the guy let you down, not your talent.
I put myself out there, and they didn't want me.
What's it going to take for me to get you to see your spark?
Oh, you're blaming on me that your husband's jealous of your talent.
There's a big difference between you and me. I was a hack.
Come on, girl. This is meant to be upbeat, not uptight. Get happy.
What's the name of that song? It's a great song.
You think about it?
Think about it. It's in my system. Think about it. I can't get it out. God,
give me strength. God, give me strength. Give me strength. Give me strength.
We'll be back next week with Skiz Sizzik talking about Allison Anders' Grace of My Heart, starring Ileana Douglas, who I say has some of the most beautiful eyes in all of cinema history. That's just me, next to Betty Davis. For more on Superbman, check out our website. That's projection-booth.com. We have a link up there and other things where you can learn more about it. Also, make sure to catch the Projection Booth on iTunes, Stitcher, and also via our website, as I said, projection-booth.com. Make sure to leave us some feedback, as we'd love to hear from you. And may the force be with you, I guess. What do you say, Mike?
Sounds good to me.
Thank you.
folks. I hope that works for you.